Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, music contributor Bob Weinberg speaks with blues man Albert Castilla about his new CD, Solid Ground. Candace Russell describes Haitian art and her new book, Masterpieces of Haitian Art. Chef Norman Van Aken serves up a word on food, and our Broward Arts Calendar features Jody Horn-Leschinski. A world premiere will soon open on stage Saturday, May 3rd at MTC's Intimate Art Deco Theater. Here's Judith Bishop to tell us more.
Vibrant theater is organic. It's always growing and always changing. The Miami Theater Center underwent a major change several years ago when it transitioned from the child-oriented playground theater to one that serves both adults and children. The hybrid troupe is now in its 10th season, and more than its name has changed. They now have a main stage and a smaller theater that seats 50. The center also offers promising playwrights a 5-week residency to develop, rehearse, and perform new work. Every cultural institution has a visionary who takes the project from dream to reality. The prime mover behind the Miami Theater Center is Stephanie Anson, its founder and artistic director. She's a Miami native who earned degrees at Brown and Columbia Universities, then worked for 16 years in New York and Boston, where she studied, acted, and directed. When she returned to Miami, Stephanie worked at Summer Shorts before founding her own theater company. Stephanie Anson is our guest today on South Florida Arts Beat. Stephanie Anson, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. You know, it strikes me that you are one of the lucky people. You have a passion for theater, and you were able to turn that into a full-time career that not only indulges your passion, but also benefits our community. When did you fall in love with theater?
I fell in love with it when I was cast as a tree in Winnie the Pooh. In summer camp.
What kind of tree?
Well, it was a tree without any lines, and I was very bitter. And so I decided that I would make it my project to get bigger parts in the future.
It's funny. I think Barbara Walters once asked someone what kind of a tree they would be as a way of psychoanalyzing them during an interview. So that was the beginning, huh? And you were hooked.
I was hooked, and I was more focused on playing the piano at that point. I was a musician. And then the next phase of getting hooked was I went to a summer camp in Massachusetts. It's a performing arts camp. And I was cast as the alcoholic father in Big River.
Well, that wasn't typecast.
Not at all. It was not at all. And all the adults were in shock. And they said, wow, you need to keep doing this. And I did. I kept acting. And then in college, I realized I really wanted to direct, that I was always having an outside view from the inside, and it wasn't necessarily helpful for my happiness. So I kept learning about performing and acting and directing a little bit, but it was after college that I started experimenting with directing, and then a few years later applied to grad school for directing.
Well, acting, writing, directing, that's a great foundation to be an artistic director of a theater company. Where are you most comfortable? Is there one aspect of theater that you really enjoy the most?
Well, I was thinking about that this morning. If I had to give up everything except one, I would hold on to directing.
Because of the control of the vision?
I hope it's not control. I hope it's expression of a vision and the physicality of the vision and the collaboration with everybody involved. I like the experience of bringing the best I can out of the composer, the designer, the actors, the technicians, everybody involved. Find the way to make people feel engaged and do great work and surprise me. Give someone an idea and they give a result that's even better than I imagined. That's incredibly fulfilling.
There are different kinds of directors. There's the nurturing, almost maternalistic director. There is the general Patton director, my way or the highway. How would you characterize your approach to it?
Lately, I've been doing backdoor directing, where I'm creating an atmosphere and a language and a safe environment and having people find the dynamics and the relationships without realizing what's happening. And then when I have to be a little more Patton-esque, like go here, go there, there's an underlying texture and web that's holding the ensemble together. So they trust the process. So there has to be a patent element in there for me. There has to be that final say. But it helps to have trust and understanding and a feeling that we're all in it together underneath it.
You're a triple threat, acting, writing, directing. You weave from one to the other. How do you find this transition enhances your ability to run a theater company?
I've put acting aside because I like rehearsing, but I don't like performing. So I really love the process of creating. And as a writer, the play, I know, doesn't exist until it's on stage with the actors and then with the audience. So I understand that as a writer because I'm a director. So if I write something with my collaborator, Fernando Calcedilla, and I'm writing it, and then I go in and I'm directing it, I'm not precious about it. I'm not holding on to it. I'll cut lines. I'll restructure. I'm watching the piece evolve. I feel like we have to be really quiet and let the play emerge, and I'm not afraid to slash things that are getting in the way.
You mentioned Fernando, your writing collaborator. You co-write most of your scripts. How do you do that? Do you take one scene, he takes another, or do you write it line by line together in the same room at the same time?
It's different for every play, for sure. But the main stages are we come upon an idea together, either through researching stories or we'll say we want to make a play for this particular actress and then we try to find an idea. So we start the research together. Then at some point we start outlining the story. And we always have to do more research along the way to fill in the gaps of the story. He's amazing at that. Like I'll say, I need to find a Sumerian goddess of merriment, laughter, something like that. And then he'll find it. That actually exists. She's the Sumerian goddess of merriment and beer. She existed. Or I'll need to find some specific plot point in history that we can bounce off of, and he'll find it. So we're researching together. We make the structure together. And then I start writing dialogue. But when we wrote Three Sisters, we did go line by line with six translations of Chekhov's Three Sisters. We had four English translations. We had a literal translation from Russian to English. And then we had the Google translation. And we went through all six line by line, trying to understand the essence of the lines. We translated the whole thing. And then I went through and started editing and shaping and making a cohesive voice. With this play that's opening next week and everybody drinks the same water, there was a lot of line-by-line work because we were trying to find a balance between working from history, from some real historical characters and a real historical event, and creating a compelling story. But there were scientific things we had to research, historical things we had to research, and it's a murder mystery, which is a new genre for us, so that logic took a lot of step-by-step line by line working, and then I'll go back and massage it and love it and make it easier to say.
Well, you mentioned research, and as you say, there was quite a bit in this latest venture. It's a murder mystery set in 13th century Spain in Cordoba. Well, you co-wrote it, and you are directing it, so you tell us the plot elements without giving away who actually done it.
Okay. So the story begins in 1236 in the month of June in Cordoba, Spain, and the Christian king has just taken over the city of Cordoba after 500 years of Islamic rule. So it's the day that the Christian king enters the city. His mother, Queen Berenguela, is a very powerful woman. We're amazed that there hasn't been a Maggie Smith movie made about her. She comes into the castle, her son lays down to take a nap. Someone brings him a glass of water, and he becomes violently ill. So, of course, she assumes it's a revenge act from the Muslims. And she starts looking into this and interrogating the leader of the Muslim community. That's a knee-jerk reaction. Does that sound familiar? Blame the Muslims?
It sounds very contemporary,
yes,
actually.
Yes, exactly. But then slowly they learn that it's not just the king who's been poisoned, it's the whole Christian neighborhood. It's not just the Christian neighborhood that's been poisoned, it's the whole Jewish neighborhood. And it's not just the Christian and Jewish neighborhood, it's the whole Muslim neighborhood as well. It's the entire city. The water in the entire city has been poisoned. So those three religious groups have been living together pretty harmoniously until this moment. And now they start pointing fingers at each other. And it becomes violent. And what happens is the Christian prince, who's a teenager, a Jewish girl who's a teenager studying to be a midwife, and a Muslim teenage girl who is a copyist at the court. She works for her father, who's the head judge. The three of them decide, look, our parents, our elders are just finger-pointing and name-calling, and it's getting violent, and they're just motivated by fear. We need to get beyond this. We need to find a solution. And I'm not going to tell you how, but they're the ones who find out the cause, and they find the solution.
Sounds like a relevant play. Not only is the water poisoned, but the atmosphere as well.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us. It was great having you on South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you.
In conjunction with their new production, Everybody Drinks the Same Water, there will be two free events. One, a medieval street fair on Sunday, May 4th from 12 to 6 o'clock. That'll be outside the theater, which is located at 9806 Northeast 2nd Avenue in Miami Shores. Later in the week, on May 7th, they're holding an academic panel on modern-day Spain at 8 o'clock at Books and Books in Coral Gables. For more information, log on to info@mtcmiami.org or telephone 305-751-9550. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC and CNBC. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment. It's South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Later on the program, Candace Russell talks about her latest publication, Masterpieces of Haitian Art. Chef Norman Van Aken delivers A Word on Food, and our Broward Arts calendar features Jody Horn-Leschinski. Now, music contributor Bob Weinberg checks in with South Florida's signature blues man.
Help me, please. Give me patience for these fools surrounding me.
With his latest recording, Albert Castilla has truly gone international. The 44-year-old blues guitar hero, who has built a rabid following here in South Florida, has released his sixth CD, Solid Ground, on the German-based Roof label. Castilla has also just returned from a European tour that brought him through Belgium, the Netherlands, France, the UK, Germany, and Austria during the past few months. He returned momentarily in February to perform at the Riverwalk Blues Festival in Fort Lauderdale before jetting back to the continent to finish out the tour. As the wheels of Castilla's plane touch the tarmac at Fort Lauderdale Airport, he'll hit the ground running, maintaining a breakneck pace through the Sunshine State. Fort Lauderdale, Bradenton, St. Petersburg, and Fort Myers are all on the itinerary, which begins this Saturday with a CD release party at the Downtowner Saloon in Fort Lauderdale. And certainly Solid Ground is well worth celebrating. Castilla displays his deep knowledge of the blues idiom, pulling licks from his solid-body Delaney guitar that recall the steely textures of Buddy Guy, John Lee Hooker, and Hubert Sumlin. His voice is deeply soulful, reflecting the time he spent on stage and on the road with blues performers such as Junior Wells and Sandra Hall, not to mention Miami mentor Graham Wood Drought of Ico Ico fame. Drought's influence also can be heard in Castilla's original tunes, which make up the bulk of Solid Ground, as well as the guitarist's heartfelt rendition of Drought's Celebration and Searching the Desert for the Blues. On stage, Castilla often reveals more of a rock-edged jam aesthetic, but here, he variously dips into bouncy Chicago shuffles, humid Memphis mood setters, and even classic Philly soul. Castilla recently spoke with South Florida Arts Beat at the WLRN studios in Miami about his recent travels and his new recording. Albert Castilla, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you, Bob.
We're so happy to have you back here in the USA.
It's good to be home.
Really so is. You just got off the plane and you were in where?
I was in Belgium, Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, France. Yeah,
wow.
I think that's it. I think that's where I was. I was in Luxembourg I was all over the place in the last 3 months.
Did you have a favorite tour stop or something that sticks out in your mind?
Man, it was all great, but the Netherlands was a lot of fun. It was a nice place, beautiful place. If I had to live anywhere else outside of the United States, it would probably be the Netherlands. But I enjoyed Germany a lot. There were a lot of great places in Germany. Belgium was incredibly kind to me. People in Belgium were great to me. And it was just a lot of fun. The whole tour was great. Where else? Oh, Vienna, beautiful city.
You were telling us before you also got to sample not just the local victuals, but also some great beer.
Great German and Belgian beer. Every town in Germany has their own local brew. And I think every local brew in Germany is better than any of the stuff we have here, you know.
Yeah, most likely.
Although, you know, we do have a great microbrewery scene in the United States. But, I mean, these guys, they can make beer in their sleep, you know. And it's great. I'm a Pilsner guy, and their Pilsners are amazing.
Yeah, they have a little bit more experience, I guess. It goes back probably 1,000 years of those countries.
Yeah, you know, it's very simple. Their recipes are real simple, but you can taste it. You know, that there's no garbage in their stuff. It's just fresh, real good fresh stuff there.
So on this tour, you had your guys with you, your band?
I had my bass player, Matt Schuler, with me, and then we had a Joe Voy, a drummer out of Kansas City, filling in. My drummer, Bob Amsel.
Yeah.
He couldn't make the trip, so we got Joe Voy out of Kansas City to do it. He did really well.
Oh,
he did a great job.
You were also telling me before that you were on a caravan tour, and that was sponsored by Roof Records?
Roof Records, yeah. They put on it was like a music review. It was three guitar players with a house band backing us up, and that started in January, and that ran through mid-March. I think I had 3 weeks off in between, and that was a great experience. I got to play with a chap named Lawrence Jones out of England, good young kid, and Christina Schulberg out of Norway. Yeah, that was a lot of fun, but I was really looking forward to getting the band out there
and
having them experience what I had experienced with the caravan, you know, and it was great.
Sure.
I had a great time on the last tour with the band.
So this was your first recording for Roof Records, which is based in Germany, correct?
Correct. They're based out of Germany. Yeah, Roof Records.
Yeah, so solid ground, and this is kind of a great label. It's been around for a number of years, and Thomas Roof, as we were discussing before, had a history with Bernard Allison.
Yes, and Luther Allison as well.
And Luther Allison, yeah.
And he's got a lot of great players on his roster, you know, Walter Trout, Coco Montoya, Candy Kane. I mean, the list goes on and on. I got some friends who are on the label as well, Samantha Fish and Mike Zito.
Sure. Some of us saw you with Samantha at the Riverwalk Blues Fest.
Yeah. Samantha and Mike Zito were both very instrumental in me getting the deal with Roof. They were very strong advocates for me. You know, they kept pushing Thomas to sign me. And, you know, after a few years of them bugging him about it, he just finally gave in.
Now, for you personally, does this kind of help you with international distribution and also getting in front of international audiences?
I'm sure it helps distribution-wise, but I know exposure-wise, it's helped me a lot, immensely. I mean, I covered a lot of ground on the Roof tour, and Roof's very strong in Europe as far as their distribution goes. So definitely was a great move for me to go with them. I got a whole new fan base now because of the record and because of the tour supporting the record.
Sure.
It was a good move, you know.
And this recording also, stylistically, you cover a lot of ground. You know, we've got certainly some Chicago blues, which is your background, going back with Junior Wells. And and also there's some Philly soul sound. One particular track was Love One Another.
Yeah.
Kind of sounded like a great old Philly soul classic.
Yeah. It's funny that we're talking about this now, because I wrote this song shortly after the Boston Marathon bombing. And the whole thing afterwards, and how the city had handled it, and the way everybody looked after each other.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Everybody in Boston and that Boston area that looked after each other and took care of each other after that. And it was very inspirational, and that's actually how the song came about.
Yeah.
I had this riff, and, you know, I don't know what I was channeling. I think I might have been who I was channeling. I think it was like
Tyrone Davis?
Tyrone Davis was definitely Tyrone Davis was probably the biggest name I was channeling there. It was definitely a Tyrone. I was thinking Tyrone Davis, I think, yeah.
Yeah. And while we're talking of inspirations, too, we've got two cuts on here by Graham Wood Drought. And I know you go back with Graham a long time and probably saw him Tobacco Road way back in the day.
25 years we go back.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, well, I used to go to his jam sessions in the early 90s on Mondays. Yeah. He's a great songwriter, you know. And, you know, part of my mission on this earth is to get his music out. You know, I think he's one of the best songwriters that ever walked the face of the earth. I think he's as good a songwriter as John Hiatt or Tom Waits.
Wow, sure.
I think he's up there with the Randy Newmans and the Bob Dylans of the world. I just think he, you know, I think this is a business where, you know, you have to be very lucky to get breaks, you know, and he deserves to be heard. So it's my mission to get his music out there, and this was a great opportunity to get his stuff out, you know, get his songs out.
Sure, sure.
And he wrote a couple really good ones that I had to put on there. Just Like Jesus was a no-brainer when I first heard it.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to put it on record. Celebration, I had recorded previously, but I recorded it as an acoustic track.
Yes. Yeah.
And it wasn't really how I wanted to record it, and I had a different vision for it. When I got to do this record on my own, I threw the band in there in the mix.
Yeah, and then Searching the Desert
Searching
for the Blues.
Searching the Desert was another one, which we wound up doing a music video
did for. Did a video for it. Was that your first video?
I did one years ago, but this was a real good experience, that video was.
I did also want to ask you about this great instrumental, Little Havana Blues, which is subtitled A Rose Con Mango. So can you tell us, I mean, that harks back to your roots here in Miami. You grew up, was it Coral Gables?
Coral Gables. Yeah. I grew up in Coral Gables, not too far from Little Havana, actually. I lived out on the border off of Lejeune Road, and used to make many trips to Little Havana. But actually, that song came about, I was watching the Marlins play last year, and they were getting their brains beat in. I think it was like 11-1 or something. They were at home, and I was just grooving, you know. I was playing some Latin. I was playing a Latin groove. And that's when all the stuff with the team was, all the controversy with them selling all the talent that they had away. And you know, the attendance was bad. Things were going really, really bad. And I just was staring at the TV watching the game. And the title kind of just came out of nowhere. And Arroz con Mango is like kind of like a Spanish term for like a mess. You know? So that's where I got the title from. Was from watching the Marlins play.
Well, it sounded like
I went to the game yesterday and they won. So
there you go.
They're winning me back, but I was a little mad at them back then. That was the inspiration. But when as I was playing and watching the game, I started thinking about Miami as well, you know, and the Latin and Caribbean influence that exists. And I wanted to throw that in there too. I want to represent, you know, where I come from. You know, I think South Florida's got a real heavy music scene. It had a heavy music scene. It's got a rich history. And I'm not ashamed to be from here. I'm proud of being from the area.
Yeah.
And, you know, every now and then I like to throw a tribute in.
Yeah.
You know, and Little Havana's kind of my tribute to South Florida and Miami.
Yeah, I remember seeing you in Little Havana. I think it was maybe back with the Miami Blues Authority many, many years ago in a small bar down there.
I wonder if it was the Brickell Tavern.
Might have been, yeah.
So, no, I mean, there was quite a scene back then in Miami. You know, we had quite a scene going back then in those days when you saw me, when I was just starting out. There was, you know, there was Ico, there was Pat De Leon, you know.
Sure, Fleet Starbuck.
Starbuck. Joey Gilmore was kicking butt back then, too, and Lynn Noble.
Yeah, Rob Friedman.
Oh, yeah, the Good Rockin' Johnny and the Wise Guys was a great band, you know.
Roach Thompson,
sure.
Yeah, yeah. So many greats.
Great scene, you know, and I'm proud of it, you know. I'm proud of it.
Well, Albert, it's such a pleasure to have you back in town once again, and we're looking forward to your CD release party coming up Saturday night at the Downtowner.
At the Maxwell Room, correct.
In the Maxwell Room.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well,
can't
thank
wait.
You, Albert.
Thanks, Bob.
Great seeing you again.
Thanks, brother.
The Albert Castillo Band performs at 8 p.m. Saturday at the Downtowner Saloon on the New River in Fort Lauderdale. For more information, visit downtownersaloon.com or call 954-463-9800. For more about Castilla and his new recording, visit albertcastilla.net. This is Bob Weinberg for South Florida Artsbeat.
Bob Weinberg is a writer and editor for Jazz Is Magazine and the online publication Jazz and Blues Florida. You can contact him at bobweinberg@mac.com. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will continue here on WLRN and WKWM in just a moment. Welcome back to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Hello, Ed Bell with you. Coming up on the program, Chef Norman Van Aken offers a word on food, and Jody Horn-Leschinski has our Broward Arts calendar. Now, writer and collector Candace Russell talks to contributor Judith Bishop about Haitian art and her new publication, Masterpieces of Haitian Art.
Art reflects society, the history, mores, and pulse of a given country at a given time. Picasso was quintessentially 20th century Spain, just as Rembrandt reflected the Netherlands in the 1600s. The same should hold true for Haitian art, but there's a disconnect. The art is vibrant, colorful, and joyful, while the history of Haiti has been marred by tragedy, earthquakes, hurricanes, flood, and poverty. Scholars have attempted to reconcile this disconnect, and that's part of our focus today on South Florida Arts Beat. Our guest Candace Russell is a familiar name in the South Florida arts world. She was a film and theater critic at the Sun Sentinel and an editor at Parkland Magazine. Her new book, called Masterpieces of Haitian Art, is a definitive survey covering the last 25 years. Candace Russell has visited Haiti often, befriending artists and collectors, and all the time collecting and curating exhibits, including one several years ago at the Bass Museum. That exhibit featured the collection of film director Jonathan Demme. Candace Russell, welcome to South Florida Arts Beat. Great to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Judith.
I think that, you know, looking back, we have all eaten in restaurants with original artwork on the wall, and most of us really don't pay much attention to it. But you, however, are quite an exception. If my research is correct, your love affair with Haitian art all started in a Washington, D.C. restaurant many years ago. Can you describe that experience and the impact on your career?
Yes, I can. I was in a dark panel, low-ceilinged restaurant in the nation's capital, and it was the kind of dark wood tone atmosphere that would have led me to feel maybe a little claustrophobic and sad. Instead, I felt a sense of joy. By looking all around me, there were these odd-shaped, long, thin, tall, wide paintings, all very joyful, all very colorful. Seaside scenes, people tilling the fields, bright colors. And I asked the owner, "What are these paintings?" And he said, "Oh, they're all from Haiti." Well, even though I lived in South Florida, my only connection to Haiti as a place was the Steely Dan song, Haitian Divorce. So when I got back to South Florida, I was determined to find, what is this thing called Haitian art? And that set me off on a trip to Coconut Grove, where I discovered some Haitian art galleries, fell in love with my first painting, and eventually bought it. The gallery was going out of business. It was by La Fortune Felix. The painting is called Ceremony, and it's pictured in my book, Masterpieces of Haitian Art. So that was the start.
Since then, you have traveled to Haiti several times, where you met and befriended many artists and many collectors. Many of them are featured in your book. Did they all survive that last devastating earthquake, and what kind of an impact did the quake have on their art?
Well, not all of them survived the earthquake, but some of them died of natural causes after the earthquake. So the landscape of Haitian artists has changed greatly. I know that there are artists who have incorporated that tragedy into their messaging or imagery in Haitian art. One of them is a Haitian expatriate artist named Eric Jean Louis, who used to live in South Florida and now lives in New York. So Haitians are very resourceful in incorporating current events into their artwork.
Who were the giants of Haitian art?
Oh, my gosh. Certainly the grandfather of the mid-century Haitian art renaissance is Hector Hippolyte, who is pictured in my book, Masterpieces of Haitian Art. There are also others such as André Pierre, Jacques Enguerrand Gourgues, Gerard Valsin. The list goes on and on. Missius Stéphane. There are so many. All the Sans-Soleil artists I would put in the top-tier category as well. And the five originals were Prosper Pierre-Louis, Lavoie Exil, Dennis Smith, Louisiane Saint-Florent, and, oh my gosh, now I can't think of the fifth.
Well, you've given us quite a few. Has Haitian art evolved the way European art and American art has? I mean, can you tell the difference, say, between a Leonardo vintage and an Impressionist vintage and a Picasso vintage in Haitian art the way you can in other art?
I don't think so, but I do think that the Haitians, again, going back to the resourcefulness of them, they are able to incorporate found materials into their artwork. And what I think is amazing and ironic and wonderful all at the same time is that the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere has the greatest visual output of a high caliber, and that includes recycling of oil metal drums and transforming them into artworks such as mermaids or fish or lizards or the sun and the moon. Both painted and unpainted metal is a very great art form within Haitian art. Also, voodoo flags, which came out of the tradition of voodoo ceremonies in Haiti. These are sequin and beaded squares of cloth hand-sewn to represent the voodoo spirits. A whole pantheon of them influence Haitians' lives in all kinds of ways, from the prosperity of crops to their fortune and romance. So I don't think we can date them quite the way we do or see the evolution of European artists as we do in Haiti. They're too individualistic. And Haiti's a unique case. It's a unique case not only in the Caribbean, but I think in the world.
What is it about the Haitian psyche that allows the joyful, exuberant, innocent, colorful artistic strain to coexist sometimes on the same canvas with the darker voodoo aspects? It seems that they're two divergent strains, yet they can play out on the same work of art.
Yeah, I don't think there's necessarily a contradiction between the two. I think they both come from the same source, which is a profound wellspring of faith and a belief in people's ability to overcome, persist, and determine that they will survive. So I think that survivalist streak is very strong, but faith goes hand in hand with that, whether it's an expression in voodoo or Christianity. So those two things go side by side. Where the interest in color comes from is really unbelievable and unique. It doesn't happen in Jamaica the same way. It doesn't happen in the Dominican Republic, which shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti. So it really is a remarkable feat. Yes, Haiti was colonized by the French and the Spanish. Certainly they had their influence on all kinds of Catholic rituals and voodoo rituals as well, where the voodoo flag tradition reflects that. But it is a unique case. Haiti is a unique case.
It certainly is, and tomes have been written about it and will continue to be.
Yes.
Your book certainly concentrates on the great Haitian artists of the past and the present. What about the future? Who are the young superstars that we should be attuned to?
Well, it's hard to say because many of them are either not painting right now or going into other fields, but some of the undersung artists that I have included in the book, like Joralis Joseph, who won a prize in the Caribbean for his artwork and was affiliated with Le Centre d'Art, the Center of Art in Port-au-Prince, is one of them. Natasha Philogene, she's from the other side of the island from Port-au-Prince. Françoise Eliasson, who is the wife of André Normil, a very famous Haitian artist. Jalem Buteau and Jacques Valmador, I all think are undersung, underrated artists, but there are so many. Also, there are the painters of the Grand Rue, and they have been developed with Sean Penn's non-governmental organization that has helped them develop their artwork from found materials. So those are certainly rising superstars within the field of Haitian art.
Now, for our listeners who may not be able to go to Haiti to see Haitian art, where are the best places to see it right here in South Florida?
Well, the best places to see it, I have a website, www.haitiana.com. I have a number of pieces of Haitian art there, as does Katie Barr on her website. She used to be based in Delray Beach, but now is totally online at the Haitian Art Collection. And in Key West, there's the Haitian Art Company that is totally devoted to Haitian art. So those are the local places that I know that you can find it. Certainly, there are local museums as well, Boca Raton Museum of Art and the Museum of Art in Fort Lauderdale have small but select collections of Haitian art.
Great information. Candace Russell, thank you so much for joining us today on South Florida Arts Beat.
Thank you.
Candace Russell's new book is titled Masterpieces of Haitian Art, a volume that gives third world art the attention usually reserved for first world collections. It's published by Schiffer Publishing Limited. For more information, you can log on to Candace's website, haitiana.com. For South Florida Arts Beat, this is Judith Bishop.
Judith Bishop is a television journalist who has covered breaking news, politics, and the arts for WABC and CNBC. Please stay with us. South Florida Arts Beat will return in just a moment.
Every day, baby.
Welcome back to South Florida Arts Beat here on 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Ed Bell with you. And now, Chef Norman Van Aken gives us a word on food.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the fram-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. Shoot, do, de, do, ya, do, do.
Hi, I'm Norman Van Aken, and welcome to A Word on Food. Today's word on food is sopa de pollo. We were in the Miami International Airport, joined in a shuffling line of other travelers at La Carreta, the famously successful Miami restaurant chain that also boasts Versailles and Casa Juancho in its culinary stable. It is one of our common stops in that airport, despite the lines. They also own a number of the outlets for other food, but it is the original that gets our attention. Primarily, that has to do with my wife, Janet, and her allegiance to their egg sandwiches. But it was the aroma of sopa de pollo that was seducing my nose on our most recent visit. The gentleman in front of me in the queue was juggling a myriad of traveler's trappings that included sliding the plastic red cafeteria tray while also manning his ringing cell phone in one hand and what might have been either a stargazer's telescope or fishing poles in a long cardboard cylinder in the other. He looked worried about having to set his packages down while jockeying the piping hot bowl of his sopa to a table in the bustling dining room. I volunteered to watch his stuff while I waited for our egg sandwich. I ordered it with my lousy kitchen Spanish that my son would cringe at, but I still usually get smiled at for effort. My fellow airport denizen dropped off his tray laden with the aromatic broth-based soup and came back to pay and get the remainder of his things. By then, I had added a sopa de pollo to our order. I knew we wouldn't be able to eat it all, but when you are about to board a plane, you often look at life with a bit more carpe diem spirit. In a continuation of said spirit, I ordered two beers as well. Little did I know that when I was grown, I would be comparing my mother's chicken soup to sopa de pollo. Had I grown up in places like Japan or modern-day New York City, I might be cherishing a bowl of ramen and thinking that it is much like my mother's chicken noodle or this Spanish-name version of edible equanimity. Though my mother would not have been as nearly concerned with the noodles nor the stock as the modern-day ramen zealots are. Ramen is rightfully as revered as it is in the zeitgeist of today's America, and I'm glad. The reason is that it requires making a beautiful stock. If there is one thing that I think people should not be without, it is homemade stock. And the go-to stock of all time is chicken stock. When I arrived at the table Janet was saving for us, she looked at the soup and cocked an eyebrow my way. "This is not the tradition we follow," it seemed to say. But she knows that when it comes to my curiosity in terms of food, she too is ultimately along for the ride. The vegetables were softer than what a classic French chef might expect. The noodles would not make a ramen disciple bow, but it was damn good. And the cold beer helped me balance the temperatures in my spoon's trips to my gratified mouth. I answered an ancient riddle in my own fashion and dipped my egg sandwich deep into the chicken noodle / sopa de pollo, and it all crossed an ancient road within me. I'm Norman Van Aken, and that's my word on food.
Norman Van Aken is the author of My Key West and is also the director of restaurants for the Miami Culinary Institute and Tuyo in downtown Miami. Please tune in tomorrow morning at 8:34 on Weekend Edition to hear Culinary Couples. And here's our South Florida Arts Beat entertainment calendar. And today we welcome back Jody Horn-Leschinski, Assistant Director of the Broward Cultural Division. Great to have you back with us, Jody.
Well, it's great to be here, Ed.
And let's find out what's happening in Broward County.
Well, first of all, Broward Cultural Division is commissioning multiple professional artists or artist teams to design and implement murals in celebration of Broward County's centennial. And the centennial is being called Broward 100, celebrating the art of community. Broward Cultural Division is also seeking the assistance of Broward cities and community redevelopment agencies to identify specific prominent outdoor locations for the 9 or more murals, as well as potential partnerships with public and private entities. All Broward cities are invited to apply for this call to cities. The online application deadline for both calls is May 4th. Broward 100 will commemorate the centennial with bold, innovative art and performance projects that attract visitors and bring residents together using our arts, sports, and recreation venues, natural attractions, and incredible diversity to creatively bridge, bond, and build their communities. Visit the Broward Cultural Division website to see a full version of the call to artists and call to cities. Broward-based artists and not-for-profit cultural organizations are invited to attend a workshop to learn how to apply for Creative Investment Program funding. The Tuesday, April 29th workshop is for artists, and the Wednesday, April 30th workshop is for organizations, and both workshops take place at 5:30 p.m. in the Broward County Main Library on the 7th floor. And the application deadline is Monday, June 1st. There is no fee for the workshop, but RSVPs are requested. Committed to bringing arts and culture to the community, the newly renovated Westfield Broward Mall is pleased to announce the opening of their new art gallery. The exhibitions will be changed every 6 weeks, and they will have an artist gallery reception. Artists can submit their work for consideration to broward@westfield.com. And now there's plenty of events coming up this weekend.
I bet.
Starting with dance. The Ukrainian Dancers of Miami presents a Ukrainian montage on Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. The Ukrainian Dancers of Miami follows the techniques of Vasil Avramenko, who is responsible for bringing Ukrainian folk dance to North America. This Friday and Saturday, the Coral Springs Center for the Arts presents a salute to Andrew Lloyd Webber at 7:30 p.m. You will hear selections from The Phantom of the Opera, Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, Sunset Boulevard, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, The Women in White, Aspects of Love, and Love Never Dies. The Children's Book Fest is a week-long celebration of children's literacy, and it culminates on Saturday at 10:30 a.m. with a family-friendly festival at the North Regional Broward College Library. Emphasizing the importance of advocating for literacy for every child in the community, the festival features free book giveaways, arts and crafts, storytellers, and appearances by local authors. Bonnet House Museum and Gardens will be hosting an Earth Day celebration on Sunday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Enjoy Native American storytelling and a live animal presentation featuring birds of prey. The day's activities also include performances by the Gold Coast Youth Orchestra, a fun sing-along, and a lecture about the conservation efforts at Birch State Park. On Saturday, in honor of Holocaust Remembrance Day, join the Jets and Generation Z for the film The Art of Caring and a discussion with Holocaust survivors at NSU's Museum of Art, Fort Lauderdale, from 6 to 8 p.m. Afterwards, the free Shark Shuttle offers transportation to Fat Village's Art Walk. ArtServe hosts Spiritual Sound of Violin on Saturday at 6 p.m. With her singing violin, Maestro Kala Ramnath stands among the best violinists in the world. Grammy nominated for her album Miles from India, she is recognized as one of the 50 best instrumentalists of the world. Her music is frequently featured in Hollywood soundtracks, including the Oscar-nominated Blood Diamond and many others. On Saturday at 8 p.m., Parker Playhouse rocks with the group Under the Street Lamp. Fresh from filming its second PBS special, Under the Street Lamp, America's Modern Day Rat Pack brings an unforgettable evening of classic hits from the American radio songbook. You'll hear classic doo-wop, Motown, and old-time rock and roll hits, along with your favorite music from the Beach Boys, the Beatles, the Four Seasons, Elvis Presley, and more. Under the Street Lamp will be joined by Gentleman's Rule, a phenomenal group of singers from Indiana University who take a cappella entertainment to a whole new level. The Broward Stage Door Theater's Theater One, Over the River and Through the Woods, introduces the audience to Nick, a single Italian-American guy from New Jersey living near his grandparents. He announces that he has gotten a great job and is moving away, and thus begins their plans to keep him at home. It's a sparkling family comedy loaded with laughs every step of the way. Over the River and Through the Woods continues through May 11th. Spend a night out with Sherlock's Dinner Theater, Maria's Girls' Night Out at the Coral Springs Center for the Arts, weekends through May 25th. This is the only interactive Girls' Night Out show in the country. Maria's best friends have planned a big night. They have invited some of the hottest guys to give Maria and her friends, that's you, a night of entertainment they'll never forget. Experience a night of comedy, drinking, dancing, and steamy fun. If you would like more detailed cultural event information, please visit artscalendar.com, Broward County's complete guide to the arts. Never miss a thing. Get there.
Thanks to Jody Horn-Lashinsky, Assistant Director of the Broward Cultural Division, for all of that information. Thanks again, Jody, and enjoy your weekend.
You too, Ed. See you next time.
The Frost School of Music at the University of Miami features their New Horizons Band in performance tomorrow, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. till 11 a.m. in the Fillmore Rehearsal Hall on campus in Coral Gables. It's a free concert, family-friendly, so if you'd like more information, call 305-284-6252 during normal business hours today. And at Culture Shock, Miami.com. Students aged 13 through 22 can purchase very inexpensive tickets to the best cultural arts events in Miami-Dade County. A second very inexpensive ticket can be purchased for an individual of any age to join them, so think about treating your mom on Mom's Day. Go to CultureShockMiami.com or call 305-375-1949 for more information. We'll rebroadcast South Florida Arts Beat tonight and every Friday night at 7 o'clock on our WLRN Extra HD channel. You can tune in on your HD radio or go to our website at WLRN.org for more information. And that's today's edition of South Florida Arts Beat. We hope you enjoyed the show. I'm Ed Bell, producer and host. Our theme was composed by Mike Levine and performed by Mike and Sam Levine. Paul Leary is our online producer. Thanks to our technical director today, Andy Wagner, and our contributors, Judith Bishop, Bob Weinberg, Norman Van Aken, and Jody Horn-Lashinsky. Please call us with your comments, 305-995-2258. You can fax us your event information, 305-995-2221, or email it to us at info@WLRN.org. We'd like to hear from you. Monday at this time, Topical Currents with hosts Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, Monday at 1 o'clock. Have yourself a great weekend, and please, as always, keep your dial set right here to 91.3 WLRN and 91.5 WKWM. Until next time, this is Ed Bell saying bye-bye. Enjoy.